Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I'm excited to have three wonderful friends on to talk about a subject that blew up the internet this last week. It was a post by Brian Whitney, and in this post, he frames the LDS church history from its earliest attempts with Joseph Smith, you know, getting people to write the history of the church, onto B.H. Roberts, onto the influences of Joseph Fielding Smith, on past that up until the present moment, you know, Boyd K. Packer's The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect and things like this. But Brian was telling the story in such a way that he really humanized the people and did a lot in some ways to make sort of understandable the way that history has been presented, you know, through all these different phases of church history and then up till now, of course. I think one of his famous lines in the piece is, "And then the internet happened." We know that the church has this big wrestle with its history and how to present it, and Brian's initial thesis was sort of a strong statement of, I think it's time that we quit saying that the church has lied to us about its history. And to Brian's credit and through the wonderful exchanges that happened on the net the next couple of days, Brian has reframed that to a much, would you say, tamer title, Brian? History versus Heritage. Maybe we should stop saying that we've been lied to by the church. So I thought it was a good exchange, and I thought you handled wonderfully those criticisms of, like, don't tell me what to say and think.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, it's good to have you back, brother. You were just on in the last few weeks. We've had you twice in the last maybe five weeks or so. Appreciate having you back. Would you quickly remind everybody of who you are and kind of what you do and stuff?
Sure. So I live in Utah, and up in Brigham City, moved there over the summer. Grew up in Seattle, so outside of kind of the Jell-O Belt. Moved over to Utah in 2011 to start attending school. I'm a history major, just finishing up at Weber State University. And let's see, I did an internship with the LDS Church History Department 2013 and 2014, and had a great experience of working directly with the director of publications. And he, along with historian Ronald Walker, co-authored a book that was recently put out by Oxford University Press titled The Prophet and the Reformer. It's the documentary of the correspondence between Brigham Young and Thomas L. Kane. And I was able to be a research assistant on that project, which was a lot of fun. And then from there, went out to Nauvoo over the summer. I got to know the Community of Christ's historic sites. Lachlan Mackay is...
And now a new apostle for them.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to mention that. He was, he still is, historic sites director. Now he's been called as a new apostle for the Community of Christ. So the Community of Christ offers a research fellowship out in Nauvoo at the portion of Nauvoo that they manage, the Joseph Smith Historic Site. And it's typically for students. A lot of the students come through their university, Graceland University, which is a liberal arts college in Lamoni, Iowa. But they informed me that they do offer it to anybody. They've had a couple of LDS historians out there in the past. So I applied for it, and they gave it to me. And so I got to spend the summer of 2014 out in Nauvoo, working on the site, doing some research on the Nauvoo house properties, which was a big point of it was problematic between Emma and Brigham at the time that Brigham was trying to get all the saints collected together to start heading west. And then I was doing site tours for people that would come through. So I really got to know the power of public history. Nice. and really took a fondness for it. After returning from there, I got a job at Weber State Special Collections Department. Then I started working with Greg Coford Books, and now I am working solely with Greg Coford Books. I'm their publicist, and I'm doing history editing with them.
Super. And then you run Mormonism in Context, which is your own blog website.
Yeah. Mormonism in Context. I started working on that about a year ago, I guess, or maybe it was earlier this year. I think it was in February of this year. But yeah, it was a website I put together to try to give kind of a simple but comprehensive overview of church history that doesn't look past some of the more problematic and troublesome areas, but at the same time is grounding it in its social context.
Which is what you did with this post too.
Yeah. And that's, I'm a social historian by training, so that's really what it's all about for me, is contextualizing things into their environment.
Super. Thanks for being on again, brother. We'll turn into you in a second.
Thank you.
My other two guests have both been on just one time, I believe, so I don't know. Let's just have Adam go first, and then Lisa. Adam Levitt came on, I don't know, I should have looked up exactly when, but Adam was kind of co-hosted the podcast once with a fellow named Jefferson Burrell, and it was a podcast some of you may remember where he turned the microphone on to me and Nyland McBain. And we kind of fielded questions, and Jefferson and Adam didn't let us off the hook. At least that was the plan. You guys probably gave up a little bit too easy on a few of them, but don't you think, Adam?
I don't know if we, we might have been able to push a little bit harder, but I think it was a good discussion. Trying to frame how you make it through, and maybe how you've made it through to the other side, and how you see things, how you make it through Sunday.
Yeah, exactly. Well, kudos, first of all, Adam. We'll have you introduce yourself in a second. But everybody, he's speaking right now at 10:46 at night, his time in Minnesota. So besides being in Minnesota, what do you do, Adam? And how would you want to introduce yourself to everybody again?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Idaho. I'm from Treasure Valley, Idaho, in near Boise. I joined the church when I was 17. And then I went on a mission a little less than 2 years after that. So I was really zealous, really involved, really eager to learn and read everything that I was able to have provided to me, and ask as many questions as I could so that I could be caught up. It was kind of how I framed it in my mind. I wanted to be caught up with the rest of the missionaries that had a whole life to learn all about church history and all about the gospel. And so, moved out here to Minnesota. I work in corporate finance, so I'm an accountant. So part of, training for all accountants and, their education is, and why I think that this topic is really interesting is, big part of my life and a big part of what, we're taught as far as our ethics is to detect fraud, is to detect suspicious behavior. Mm-hmm. And so kind of just to be naturally skeptical of any information, not just financial information. So, when Brian had written the post and I read it, I certainly appreciated, a lot of what he said, but I think there were also some triggers, and maybe that has to do with, how I frame and, how I see the world based off of, my training for my profession.
No, you were a great conversation partner, especially those first couple of days when it was really a hot topic. Like, Brian, you did practically break the Mormon internet. But thank you, Adam, for being on and bring all those perspectives with you. We're excited to have you.
Perfect.
And thanks again for staying up so late. Now, Lisa, you're an hour less than Brian. Brian are an hour less than Adam. Thank you for staying up late and doing this. Welcome to the podcast again. I know you were on the one that we did about grieving.
Yes, and also faith transitions, and one that I really enjoyed on near-death experiences.
Oh, my heck, Lisa, you've been on more than I remembered, and that's an idiotic thing of me. The near-death one, I definitely remember your contributions on that so much. Should have looked you up, but thank you, friend. We have known each other for 15, 16 years now, and appreciated you so much. Tell us what you do now and all the different – you could do a couple of really fun things, so go, and I'm going to fill in what you miss.
Okay. Well, I am a mental health therapist at a clinic in Provo, and I have some connections also with Brigham Young University. I've been a member of the church my whole life, which is getting longer and longer. I've always been interested in the intersection of mental health issues with LDS culture, particularly social issues, faith issues, Mormon history issues, especially how marginalized groups function within LDS culture. That seems to be where my main emphasis is right now.
Awesome. Do you want to say what you do on Sundays and at least practice during the week and things? Or you don't have to. And we can cut this out.
Right now I do sing with the Tabernacle Choir. I don't know how relevant that is to what we're talking about.
Oh, it's cool.
I tend not to sing any part of this.
Okay. Is that something we should cut out?
I don't think it matters. Okay. Unless I say something really controversial.
Yeah,
that
then we'll have to. Okay,
out.
Then we'll cut that out. Sounds good. Well, you're married to Bill. You guys live in Payson. A bunch of kids. Are you not quite empty nesters, but close?
We're pretty much empty nesters. We have a boomeranger who just graduated from university. But yeah, other than that, it's just us.
Cool. Well, you guys have been great friends to my wife, Lori, and I, and we appreciate you. And we're going to call on you for anything and all things, but especially maybe that sort of healing from, you know, how do we handle, you know, our stories crashing down on us and kind of putting it back together and you know, what's healthy and not healthy. Just
awesome.
Anything along those lines would be great. So thank you so much. All right, well, I thought we'd do this. For those of you who haven't read the piece, I thought I'd just ask Brian to start with, you know, just go through the piece, just talk us through in, you know, 10, 12 minutes or whatever it might take to kind of just hit the different phases that you talked about in your post. And then kind of talk towards the end about, you know, given this, why you think the language of lying is maybe not, it shouldn't be as prevalent as we're constantly hearing it.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the first thing to kind of put out there before really going through the essay is just to acknowledge that the way that we look at the past has changed, and will continue to change. The way that we practice history, the way that we write history, changes as society changes. And so that really is the underlying current in everything that I'm seeing here with the church and everything that I wrote about. So the other thing that's really important to put forward, which is ties directly into my article, is that really up until Leonard Arrington was called as a church historian, it was unprofessional historians that were called. It was apostles that were put into that position without any historical training or background, and that their primary function was to preserve records, not to analyze them, and not to publish on them. They were mostly just to try to keep them. And it really goes back to the very first days of the church with the revelation that says that a record shall be kept among my people. And that's the model that the church used for quite some time, beginning with Joseph Smith commissioning about 20 different writers to start collecting the history, start writing about the history, and to be preserved. Now, the way that they saw history is not the way that a scholar would see history today. The way that they saw what was going on around them was what we would call didactic. It was for the purpose of teaching a moral message and to having some sort of proof text in a way that Joseph Smith was a prophet, that the gospel had been restored, all these basic narratives that the church was proclaiming, that's what they were focusing their history on, is proving that out. Some of these were published in the Times and Seasons. The bulk of these were written after Joseph Smith and Hiram were killed. And it really wasn't until B.H. Roberts was called as a church historian that they started getting collected together. He edited them in what we know as the History of the Church, which is the 7-volume set that probably a lot of our parents have on their shelves. Maybe some of us have it on our shelves as well. But that history went up through Nauvoo period, and then there was an abridgment at the end with Brigham Young's history, just the beginning, up until 1848. And that's where that history stops. And largely a lot of it is just this kind of piecemealed collection. It's titled Joseph Smith's History of the Church, although it wasn't directly authored by him. And that's the history that the church had and ran off of for quite a while. B.H. Roberts began working on a pretty ambitious project after that he titled Comprehensive History of the Church, and that was to bring history into the 20th century. He started publishing those as article pieces in a professional historical journal about the history of Mormonism. And at the end of those articles, the First Presidency actually wanted to collect them together into a 6-volume publication and it didn't pan out. And I'm not clear as to the reasons why it didn't pan out. But later on, in about 1928, B.H. Roberts started putting those together again. And by 1930, those were published as the Comprehensive History of the Church. But they were kind of overshadowed because in between these projects, Joseph Fielding Smith was called as the church historian. And Joseph Fielding Smith, he wrote prolifically, but he also was not a trained historian. I don't really think that he spent a lot of time analyzing documents. I think that he spent a lot of time preserving documents, and we have lots of great stories about him, like tearing a sheet out of a journal that he thought was pretty relevant and stuffing it away in a safe. And we have all sorts of stories about why he would have done something like that. What was he hiding? He may have just been preserving it. I don't know. But his history that he wrote, which is called Essentials in Church History, published in 1922, really became the standard telling of our church history. And you know, if you take a look through that book, it is available online for free. You can go to archive.org. You can go several places. It's out in the public domain. But if you take a look at it, it's not really historically sourced. It's his take on history, and he, quite frankly, we have a lot of scholarship that contradicts the types of things that he was saying.
Now, two things I have in this section. What one is, he's known for arguing with B.H. Roberts within the quorum, you know. Well, not that Roberts was never in the quorum, but at least among the general authorities, they would often, you know, present differing opinions, and it was widely known. Do you think that he wrote this, got this Essentials together directly because he knew what Roberts was up to on the other one or anything like that?
You know, I don't know. That's a really good question, and I don't really have an answer for that. I do know that, I mean, politically, they were polar opposites from each other. Ideologically, as far as how you're supposed to talk about the history, they couldn't have been more different. Is it possible that what he did was to kind of try to put something out there that would supersede what Roberts is doing? I suppose, but I'm not sure that I don't know. I'm not really sure that that's what he had in mind. I don't have anything that tells me that anyway. But what I can say is that I'm pretty confident that what he put out was definitely to defend his family legacy.
Yes. And yeah, talk more about that. That was actually the other thing I wanted to talk about here. And in some ways this helps the framing that we're going to get to about whether it was lying or deceitful, or is he presenting a fraudulent thing. In some ways you're warmed. Somehow this whole Essentials and his legacy is warmed for you to the degree that you got to say, look at my dad was Joseph F., the son of Hiram, you know, who was there, you know, seeing his dad's dead body. Yeah. You know, this is a church that my family is invested in. And in many ways, he was writing a family, something to defend his family.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, there are certain things that that pop up in his history that he deals with in a way that you would expect of a descendant or a family uh-huh. member to deal with. And you know, one of those is seer stones. You know, for instance, I mean, he dismisses the seer stone story, and he says that in his writings, he says that it just didn't make any sense to him why Joseph would have to use this lesser than tool than the Urim and Thummim, which was this divine tool that came through the angelic hands, right? So why would he have to go to this earthly tool when he had this divine tool? And so he just dismissed it wholesale and said, well, I just think it was lies. And I don't think he really used a seer stone. I think he just used an Urim and Thummim. And so that's what he wrote in Essentials in Church History. And that's what ended up becoming the official narrative the Urim and Thummim story. So, you know, I mean, so yeah, part of this is just that it's his liberal, and I don't want to say, let me take back the word liberal, because I don't mean it in that sense. I mean like taking liberal,
liberty.
Yeah, thank you. Taking liberties with the history. And just, if he didn't buy something, he didn't put it in there. Mountain Meadows is another one. Mountain Meadows Massacre, he believed it was the Indians that were primarily, the Paiutes that were primarily responsible. And he believed that Brigham Young he wept when he found out about this atrocity.
Right.
You know, he didn't make the connection with the saints doing this, because to him that was just an implausible idea. And so that's what became the official narrative.
There's another moment I remember. He didn't like the King Follett discourse, and so at least sometime in when he had influence, he had it removed from the history of the church, only to have Roberts, you know, make it go back in later, right? I'm not remembering the details, but so that fits right with, you know, Adam, if he doesn't God buy it, it's not there,
Exactly, and so that's somebody, that's, you would expect that from somebody who, A, isn't trained in history, B, isn't even trying to be objective about history, and C, is protecting a legacy and a heritage of from his own family line and from the church. Now, the unfortunate thing is that that became the official narrative. So this, I mean, this couldn't have been put out at a more opportune time to become the official church narrative. This is right at the beginnings of correlating our Sunday school curriculums. And Joseph Fielding Smith was, just prior to being called as a church historian, he was the general superintendent of the Sunday school program. And he was also the president of the Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association. So, you know, he's tapped into the education of youth, he's tapped into the curriculum, and now he's doing publications. And these are really kind of the beginnings of what ended up coming out of our Sunday school manuals. And so they were all based on the way that he viewed and he looked at history. So what I argue is that this is what all of our leaders have grown up hearing and believing, and having no reason in their minds to doubt otherwise. You know, this is the story that they learned when they went to seminary, when they went to institute, when they were attending Sundays, and they've never... Well, I mean, I can't.
And the nature of their calling isn't to do historical research. Yeah, it's it's to teach and to strengthen and inspire.
And I don't want to put out a generalized other approach on it, because certainly there are some general authorities that were more interested in learning about history than others. But I would say, by and large, quite a few of them, I don't think it ever really dawned on them to really like investigate more deeply. And I think that they were very quick, and for them, their testimonies were strong enough, I suppose you can say, to where if they did hear an alternative narrative, it just deflected right off of them. So when Fawn Brody published in 1945, No Man Knows My History, which is actually an excellently researched book, but her conclusions that she's reaching at are obviously to discredit Joseph Smith as a prophet, well, what are they going to do except just outright dismiss any of her research? So it's just not something that's even going to, in fact, I would doubt it if many of the church leaders even ever read No Man Knows My History. They kind of pushed it all off to Hugh Nibley and said, you respond to this. We're not interested in this.
No, so, ma'am, that's not history.
Was exactly.
A poor attempt, but it was at least, it shows.
But I think that that's the pattern that we're dealing with here, is a lot of more administratively minded church leaders who have never really felt that they needed to devote themselves into a serious and in-depth study of the history of the church.
Thank you for that. And I really think that you've done a nice job, you know, in just the few paragraphs that you spent on Joseph Fielding Smith here. I also wanted to mention that you used Lindsay Hanson Park from a podcast that we did just a few weeks ago, where she's talking about there's history, there's heritage, and there's propaganda. And you made the point here that at least with Joseph Fielding Smith, instead of real history, we have a presentation of a heritage kind of... How would you say it's heritage flavored, meaning it's family and there's warmth towards it? How would you describe what you mean and Lindsay means by heritage?
Well, hopefully I mean the same thing that Lindsay means, and I apologize to Lindsay if I've butchered her intentions. But yeah, I mean, it's basically a history that isn't really grounded in source analysis and comparison and criticism. It's a history that's just, it's grounded in your feelings for your past and for the legacy of the church.
Well, thank you so much. Let's move on to, the next thing, which is finally we get some professional historians come involved. So tell us that story.
And it kind of turns out to be a mess, right? So Howard W. Hunter, he brings on Leonard Arrington with the intentions of putting out a more academic approach to history. And he renames the Church Historian and Recorder's Office. And before I go further, let me just the name itself, Church Historians and Recorder's Office, that implies that what they were mostly doing was recording and preserving records and not analyzing records.
All right, good. Right?
So now they've renamed it the Church Historical Department, or the History Department, and Leonard Arrington is tasked with publications of church history. And the first task that he's given is to create an update to Joseph Fielding Smith's Essentials in Church History, and this is what is now known as the Story of the Latter-day Saints by James Allen and Glenn Leonard. That was published, I think it was 76. And the primary purpose of that was just to bring the history up current, because, again, Joseph Fielding Smith's volume, you know, ends around 1920, and then you had B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive that ends around 1930, and now the Story of the Latter-day Saints is going to bring it up closer to 1970. And so you've had a lot of developments in the church since that time, particularly with the internationalization of the church. So they're bringing that up, but they're doing it with a slightly different approach than in the past. These are not people who are primarily ecclesiastical leaders. These are trained historians that are working on this, James Allen and Glenn Leonard. And they are trained in social history. They're trained in economic history. And so they're bringing that approach to them, which is a little bit more of a hands-off, academic distancing type approach to the history, while they do definitely do it from a faithful perspective. There's no question that they honor faith throughout the entire book. They're doing it without necessarily the kind of proof texty feel of, so then this concludes that Joseph Smith is a true prophet and that the Book of Mormon is just scripture. They're doing it a little bit more as a social history. And, you know, it gets, it's very popular. It sells very well, but it gets mixed reviews among the quorum.
Yes.
Particularly among those who are a little bit more conservative in their perspective. And I guess, you know, people can push back at me for some soft language. So when I say a little bit more conservative, I mean quite a bit more conservative.
Is Ezra Taft Benson a conservative?
Yeah, right. And Marquis Peterson both criticize the volume for really kind of removing the spiritual aspects out of history. And I think that that is so important to understand as to what really is going on here in the inside of the of the office, not just of the historian, but over across the street. Well, it wasn't across the street at the time. It was just down a lower floor of the church office building, where you've got this dialogue happening, this tension happening between Howard Hunter and Spencer Kimball and Ezra Taft Benson and Marquis Peterson over how much is this scholarly approach to history removing the spiritual aspects of history. And, you know, it's easy for us now in the 21st century and in post-internet age to look back on this and say, well, you just need to tell the truth. But what I'm really trying to push to people is that they all felt like they were approaching it from a position of truth. They were not saying, well, if we remove the spiritual aspects and we're going to have, you know, then yeah, we might have a more honest telling, but then we're not going to have, you know, we're going to have fallout. Or if on the reverse, if you, you know, keep the spirit, the spiritual aspects, then we're going to have to remove some of the history. You know, they're not thinking about it that way. I argue that they all felt like that they were coming out of a position of telling the truth, but it's just, what truth are you telling? Right. Are you telling the truth of the spirit, or are you telling the truth of academics? And I do think that they saw a distinction between the two, and I think that we still see a distinction between those two camps.
Yeah.
That there's the scholarly world and their facts and their truth, and then there's the spiritual world. And it kind of gets back down to like the romanticist argument, right? Of where does truth come from? This epistemological argument. Where does it come from? Could you trust your feelings on this stuff? Does it come through this kind of innate natural knowledge, or does it come through external evidence like the you know, those in the Enlightenment era where everything is this positivist kind of like relying on, you know, evidence based history, and you still have this opposing mindset that goes on today, and this conversation goes on today. They were experiencing this as well. So anyway, long story short, Story of Latter-day Saints, get some grief inside.
Yeah. Now let me do a little application. I may cut it later. I worked at Benchmark Books, and this was a highly sought after volume, especially the 76 edition. The picture that you show on the blog is from one that was at least 7 or 8 years later, and it is a toned down. So in other words, there was influence by Benson and Peterson and others, and Arrington and Leonard took out certain things, or, you know, maybe de-emphasized some of the more naturalistic. Hey, this was already happening in the air. where, what was it, like the word of wisdom didn't come out of the vacuum, out of a shock. There was a temperance movement, and, you know, a lot of these arguments were already going on there. And so things like that were a little bit more downplayed in that blue-covered version versus the white one.
Yeah, and one of the things that Hunter didn't care for was when they talked about religious communalism and how Mormonism was a reflection of communitarianism.
Right.
Hunter, you're right. I mean, he was actually supportive of the book, but yeah, he didn't like that Mormonism is being compared so much with the other religious movements around his time.
We wanted to be unique. This is a brand new influx of the Holy Spirit in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Instead of.
And we still see that, you know, kind of bleeding out through our curriculum and whatnot. Whenever we treat the Word of Wisdom, it's always that, you know, this was just this, nobody thought of these things before. And it's, you know, and that's the kind of story that was kind of crafted during this time. But again, you have to ask yourself, were they crafting that story because they're like, well, no, we need to keep this narrative close to our chest? Or was it because Hunter legitimately felt like the comparison shouldn't have been made? Mm-hmm. And then you have to ask, well, how much did Hunter really know about the temperance movement, you know, and stuff like that. So anyway, I just think we need to problematize the kind of the easy approach of, well, they were all fully aware of this stuff and they just chose to do this really like narrowed, you know, deceitful version of history. But, you know, moving forward from that, this is what I think is the most tragic out of all of this. Was the sesquicentennial history that was supposed to be written. And that was a 16-volume project. Now, I've heard, and I didn't put this in my article because I don't have this sourced, I heard that Richard Bushman had actually approached Howard Hunter about this and that it was his idea that he proposed, and that Howard Hunter thought it was a great idea and that he gave it over to Leonard Arrington when he called him as a church historian and said what we want is a 16-volume history of the church. But if that's how it worked out, I think that's a cool story. But even if that's not how it worked out, we do know that by 1975, there were contracts with 16 independent historians who were each in charge of writing one volume of this updated, massive, comprehensive history that was going to be done from the grounding of academic history and social history. And the very first volume that was going to be done in that was Richard Bushman's Joseph Smith and the Beginning of Mormonism. This was supposed to be published by 1980 for the sesquicentennial of the church, and things fell apart.
Well, six or seven, eight showed up eventually through the years.
Yeah, through various publishers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Arrington helped them to achieve that. I mean, Arrington felt terrible about the project falling apart. And this is all just what I understand. I didn't put this in my article because I don't have this source. This is just what I've been hearing from other people who are Arrington experts. You know, he felt terrible that the project fell apart. And so he helped a lot of these historians to try to gain some publication venues for what they did. And University of Illinois was a big publisher at that time for Mormon history, still kind of are, but they were more robust at that time, and they took a couple of them. Mormonism in Transition by Tom Alexander. And that's what an important volume that is. So, you know, I've been having fun. I've been collecting these many volumes that have been put out, and I don't know, maybe I'll write a post about what this project could have ended up as if it had come together. Because it does make me wonder, if these 16 volumes had come out, how much would that have affected our historical narrative from 1980 forward? How much more open would we have been to discussing some of the more problematic aspects? Because if you read Joseph Smith's Beginning of Mormonism from Bushman, I mean, he goes pretty far into some of the stuff that we're now starting to talk about from an official standpoint. And so I think, I don't know, I think that there would have been a difference. You know, so I think it's important we mentioned Boyd K. Packer's speech to CES at BYU, Why the Mantle is Far Greater in the Intellect. And this happens at this time, that happens in 1981. And so it seems like Packer at this point is really wanting to solidify the idea that he doesn't trust the historical approach, and that he thinks that it strips us out of the spiritual aspects of it. He literally states in there, the church, we're not neutral. We are one-sided. There is a war going on and we are engaged in it. And it's a war between good and evil. And we are belligerents in defending the good. So do we give him a pass for that? You know, and I'm not trying to exonerate him, but at the same time, we do have to understand the perspective that he's speaking of, from which is a perspective that's really grounded in this fundamentalist conservative approach to religion. And for him, history does damage to it, at least the academic approach.
And he's a former CES guy, and so he's been teaching from the old model. He saw it transform lives for the good. He just thought that's the way you should keep going.
Yeah, and if what you're doing, and this gets to his other statement that he put out there, that some things that are true are not very useful. If what you are doing, even if it is historically accurate, is removing the spiritual aspects from it, then it's not good. It's not worthwhile to us as a religion. So Boyd K. Packer is clearly not a friend to academic studies of history, and he never really has been. But so again, I'm not exonerating him for that. I'm just explaining that that's his grounding and that's his position. And so it was just a year after that that the history division was dissolved, and all the historians, including Arrington, were relocated to BYU. And I almost think it's a bit of a rub that they titled the new institute, the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute of Church History, right? I mean, it's like, remember what we expect of you, right? And I don't think so. I mean, that's my own private thought. I don't know that that's what they intended when they named it that. But I have heard that Gordon B. Hinckley was a big player in that, and that they were originally just going to just dissolve the department and everybody was just free to go after that. And I think Gordon B. Hinckley was the one who really stepped in and said, no, we really do need to continue some sort of, you know, a historical department, and perhaps it should remain in the academic sphere as opposed to the ecclesiastical sphere. And then from there, they went down there, and Arrington stayed there until he retired. As the director, he was, you know, it's a little bit of a scandal that he wasn't released with a vote of thanks publicly. He was just taken, his title was away, and,
picture was removed from church historians.
Awful stuff. But he did, they did continue to do some good work though, out of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute. There were some good publications that still came out of it. Jill Mulvey Durr's work, Ron Walker's work. You had some good historians that were working with it. And Mike Quinn was part of this whole process at this time as well. And he was one of them that ended up that helped move the records down to BYU campus from the church history library. So, you know, that's where it stayed. And effectively, we had no church history department.
Right. And then church historians from that point on have been general authorities.
Yeah, so they went back to the model of general authorities. Now, it wasn't apostles. It was mostly 70s, and it still is, actually. The executive director of the church history department is still a 70 today. But they went with a committee model between 1997 and 2005. And so for a long time, it was D. Todd Christofferson was on the committee. Marlon K. Jensen was on the committee. And they were really running the Church History Museum, the Family History Library. They didn't have the Church History Library at the time. That didn't begin construction until 2005. So the archives were effectively down at BYU, and they really weren't open to the public. They were open to faculty. So stuff was still being written, but very little of it was coming from outside. And the independent scholars, those who published with like signature books, for instance, were having to rely on manuscripts that were coming through Mike Quinn's notes or through the what we call the Mormon Underground, where there was copies of manuscripts from the archives, right? And that's where we get a lot of the history writing after that. So big transition again in 2005 with Marlon K. Jensen being called as the first church historian for a long time. Since Arrington. And the impetus for that was the Joseph Smith's paper project. And that started in 2000 at BYU. And it was underwritten by the Larry H. Miller family. And they started gathering together a group of PhD historians to begin working on it. Again, mostly in connection with BYU, but it was joint with the Church History Department in BYU for a while. Then in 2005, they reopened the Church History Department in Salt Lake City and moved the staff historians on the Joseph Smith papers up there. 2009, the Church History Department opens, and now that's where they're located today. And there's a staff of probably about I don't know, a couple dozen PhD historians that are working on that huge project with interns and assistants, and it's a pretty large department. And that's where I got to spend a couple years. And you know, so where we're at now is well, the internet happened, right?
Yeah.
And it blew the barn doors.
Everybody gets to talk, right, Adam?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It blew the barn doors open, and you know, quite frankly, and we can debate all day long about whether or not they should have seen it coming, because you know they're apostles or they're supposed to be inspired or whatnot, but they just didn't see it coming, and they weren't prepared for it. The narrative that they felt that they were promoting all along was what they really believed was the right narrative to promote, and now you've got the internet out there that's putting out. You've got all sorts of people putting out all sorts of stuff. Some of it is really good history. Some of it is not so good history. And people are finding this and saying, hey, wait a second, this doesn't measure up to what I've been taught my whole life. You guys have been lying to me. And so in response to that, you do have the church being somewhat backed into the corner. And at this point they are playing catch up. They put out the Gospel Topics essays, which, you know, I mean, we can debate how good they are. And we can also debate how, you know, whether or not they should have done that a long time ago, and not just being reactive now, but it is what it is. They're out. And they're trying to be more forthright with the things that they know are troubling people out there. Even though they're trying to do it in a way that still preserves the narrative, preserves faith, because, you know, I mean, what else do you expect, right? I mean, this is the institution itself talking. Of course, they're not just going to go out there and say, "Well, you guys caught us. We're a big phony," right? I mean, they're gonna defend themselves. So the
should they, Adam? We'll get to that.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, and I mean, one thing that I want to, and we can, you know, I'm sure that we'll discuss this again, but I, you know, one thing that I struggle with is hearing people say, well, they should just tell the truth. And I hear that all the time in response to my article. And I just see that out there. If they just tell the truth, as if the truth is some concrete, fixed form of facts. Right. And I think that a lot of that comes from people not being really aware of how history is developed and how history is interpreted, that there are historical facts, but that historical facts require piecing together, they require comparison, they require interpretation, they require being told, right? Historical facts don't yeah. speak for themselves.
Yeah. And we refer anybody at this point to the podcast that we did on the state of public history within Mormonism, yeah. this kind of stuff. We spent plenty exactly. of time on there. So, hey, I appreciate yeah. this. So the ultimate conclusion, though, is, you know, there's so much of this lying language that let's use the term, let's call a spade, let's, you know, boom, 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 boom. And your whole point was just to say there's a richer story, and just to say that they lied is too easy a narrative, and I'm trying to help complicate that. What was your goal?
Yeah, to say that we're being overly simplistic and we're being overly divisive when we say that the church has lied to us. Because I think, you know, and we can, and we'll talk, I'm sure, about lies of omission versus intent. But I think that when most people are saying the church lied to me, that they're framing it from a position that the church intentionally deceived them. And what I'm curious about, and I hope that we talk about this as a group, what I'm curious about is how necessary really is it for the posts or X or transitioning Mormon narrative to include being intentionally deceived as part of their new construct.
So in other words, would their new constructs be as powerful if they left that piece out? Or
yeah.
Okay. Great. Super, super. And you'll have chances to, you know, catch anything else you left off. So Adam, I want to turn to you. And I don't sense that you and Brian are like polar opposites. But you came in to the conversation, and you say, you know, there's still an important role for the language of lie. There's an important yeah. role for these other things. So kind of give us your take on, you know, the types of things you reacted to.
Yeah, so just to start, just to make sure, I wouldn't consider myself in either the post, the X, or even the transitioning Mormon category. So I still feel like I'm in the boat to a degree, but
it's an old ship, Zion. It is not a boat.
Oh, excuse me, the ship. Excuse me. but the you know, I think for the most part, people that maybe, I don't know, the nuanced crowd or whatever, I don't know if I agree that for people like me, of which there are many thousands, that we necessarily think that the church in the past are led by, you know, these mustache rolling henchmen that are out to get money from us to say, or out to get something from us, that they had evil intentions. And so I think that the bulk of the post that Brian had, I think is great. I mean, it goes along with what the Givens have provided, which is to provide a context around why we have the history that we have, why the things are presented in such a way, you know, in the heritage way, which is basically the telling of a family history in order to protect faith. And so I think for the most part, me at least, I don't disagree that they thought that this was the best approach. But then also I think what's important in any telling of these events is to understand who we're talking to. So even who is this post reaching that Brian has, or who, you know, when we're being asked to stop saying that we were lied to or something to that degree, I come from a generation and even from a culture now in the, you know, where it's not just history that we look at differently. We look at everything differently. We rely on information and immediate information and complete information to make decisions about everything that we do. That could be financial, that could be relationships that we have with people, but there's a huge demand in the internet, you know, in this networking that we, you know, this increased network that we have with people throughout the world facilitates that, but there's a huge demand for information in order for me to make decisions. And so for someone to think, for me, where I have an issue, and I think this is probably where a lot of people have an issue when, and I know we may get into the omission or, you know, intent thing, when information even now is being filtered to me in a way that somebody else feels like is best for me to receive it, that goes against everything else that I have going on with the way that, you know, so I can't, you know, and another thing to factor in is, so I work in the financial sphere, but it's not just specific to financial data, but there are students, and part of the education in growing up, even in high school, is we are taught to be skeptical because we live in a post Enron, post Bernie Madoff, and it's not just financial. We hear about scandals and dishonesty and lack of transparency in athletics, in civics, in government. We have hearings that we hear all over the news all the time about how we could be better transparent and how information can be given to all of us, the community, so that we can make decisions based off of that information. And so this is all old stuff that we've always been able to make, you know, purchase things with the accurate information. That's how a free market system works. If I have a lack of information to make a purchase, then the free market system doesn't work. So we have a huge demand on we have a huge demand on information, including historical information. So it's not, you know, clearly not just a shift on this information. And so the lying or whatever, the feelings of lying come into play when we feel like the current information. So again, while I agree 100% with Brian's kind of the conclusion that he has come to, or what he's presenting in the article, is, you know, the context of the heritage history was why they thought they were doing what was best. What is happening today, and not even what was happening is happening today, what was happened, say, when I joined the church. I joined the church in the year 2000, and I served a mission 2 years later. And I, in my experience, you know, as I, you know, in the introduction, why I thought it was relevant to bring that up was I had worried that I had lacked knowledge that many of the lifetime members had. And if I was going to serve a mission, I didn't want to be caught into, you know, in a discussion about some thing that I had nothing that I knew nothing about. And so, you know, read the Book of Mormon a couple times, you know, read through the Bible, went through all of the lessons. But when I realized that I knew nothing about Hans Mill, I knew nothing about all of these hot button things that were being discussed, because, you know, the Work and the Glory, you know, was popular, you know, kind of too. So,
for sure.
So this was kind of like, you know, you hear your fellow Mormons discussing some of these really, you know, heritage things. I knew nothing. And so as I approached people, I approached my seminary teacher, I asked, what should I do to learn more? And the information that I was, or what he had told me, was to read the Doctrine and Covenants. And so I said, great. I read the Doctrine and Covenants. And I thought back, and I'm like, this isn't in chronological order. I don't know how I could learn more about the events that happened from that other than, you know, to maybe piece through the headers of the Doctrine and Covenants. And so I had asked, and they said, don't worry about it, you know. And so on my own, I went through and I bought the Church History and the Fullness of Times Institute manual, and I read through that speed. And it was a decent book, you know, maybe 400 or 500 pages long, that kind of provided, you know, some information to me. But I still, you know, had no idea, clearly, as most people had no idea, even the people, maybe my seminary teacher, maybe the institute teachers that were available for me to discuss with, maybe they themselves knew nothing about it. The problem was, is there was an attitude of don't go looking. So when I'm in the, you know, and even that, professionally, go ahead.
That was rubbing you wrong back then as well. This, you recognized the don't go looking as a man. What are you doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think probably, you know, I was really zealous at the time, so I certainly trusted. So I probably wasn't getting rubbed wrong. I didn't like the answer that I was given, because I, whatever they told me to do, I would do. And so when I, you know, when you encounter anything that is troubling, the answer is those are anti-Mormon lies, or this, don't look at this information. And then when you find out, and I think this is part of it, the Boyd K. Packer approach, or when you hear, you know, about, you know, how Elder Oaks responded when, you know, Mormon Enigma in 1984, right, when that book was published. And when you hear, hey, we're, you know, our job is to protect the reputation of Joseph Smith. It is not to provide you with information. And I live in a world, like most Americans at least, where we value information to make all of the decisions. You can't help but think, and even today, as we go through, right, even, you know, I'm not, clearly not up to the knowledge level of Brian with, you know, the historical happenings, but we still have a vault of information with which limited people have access to, even today. We didn't have images of the seer stone until recently, but they've had these images all along. And when people would ask, they would deny this information. So the denial of having access to this information, when in every other facet we have this information, I think that you can't help but feeling lied to. And I think another thing that gets caught up is, well, what does it mean that the church, what does the church mean? So we say the church lied.
Right.
And say, well, did that mean my seminary teacher lied? Well, he didn't know. Did my bishop lie to me? He didn't know. But when there are people in every, again, in corporate, athletic, civic, governmental, any other type of institution, the leaders have a duty. They have governance standards that they are required to provide accurate information. And so, or they're required to at least not withhold information when it's being requested, unless, I mean, and so when we think that the church is held to a different standard than everybody else, and those people who do this, they are agents. So I guess maybe a legal term, an agent of an organization is somebody that would represent. So if a salesman sold me a product and he omitted information to me, well, the company lied to me, because that salesman is an agent for that company. And that's the same for virtually any organization. So while I completely agree with the fact that I don't think the motives all along were to lead me down some path that would lead to destruction, I don't think anybody would, I mean, most people I would suggest, I would think, wouldn't think that that's the case. But to say, stop saying that you were lied to, when in every sense of the word, I feel like information was limited, was you know, redacted or limited. So I couldn't make accurate decisions on that. So to me, that's lying. And the last thing I'll bring up is, and I know this is brought up all the time, but it's important because according to the church's own standard in the Gospel Principles, chapter 31 on honesty, it says lying is intentionally deceiving others. And I know Brian in his post says that he doesn't believe that they have intentionally deceived. It's more willful ignorance. But bearing false witness is one form of lying. And then it goes on down later on in the paragraph. There are many forms of lying. When we speak untruths, we are guilty of lying. We can also intentionally deceive others by a gesture or a look, by silence, or by telling them only part of the truth. Whenever we lead people in any way to believe something that is not true, we are not being honest. So that's what I'm taught on Sunday. And I understand that that definition means that everybody's a liar or everybody lies. But I think it's important to call out a lie, and maybe the church lied, but I don't have to call them a liar. I can say that lies were told.
Mistakes were made.
mistakes were made. But beyond that, to say stop saying that they lied, that's invalidating to people who actually and honestly feel lied to. And I don't think one person can own that. You know, one person can't tell me that I haven't been lied to if I have been lied to. Yeah. If I feel like I've been lied to, and somebody can't say, nope, you weren't lied to.
Yeah. Well, you're returning here at the end to where you started, which is, you know, here's what was told to me, and it wasn't the complete, and yet I also get the impression that the reason you're telling it to me this way is because you think this is best for me, but I want to be able to make my own decisions, and you're inhibiting me in this area of my life where all the rest of the world, it's all about giving me this information. You are choosing for me not to have information to make my decisions over.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So it was terrific. I thought you said so much so well there. Now, you can say the church lied, or you can say church leaders or corporate church, you know, messaging was a lie without being a liar. And is that where you were playing with the intent piece and you're kind of giving them some room? Because I'm just trying to get a clarification on that one. Is it because obviously lies were told by this corporate entity? You know, decision makers along the way let these things be published, you know, said these things over pulpits, but you're calling them liars as if that were some overwhelmingly defining term. I guess, you know, that's the way liar feels like, man, if the label of liar sticks, that's really an invalidating thing. And you're trying to stay away from that totally.
Yeah. I mean, see, that's, I wouldn't call President Hinckley, who was the prophet when I was baptized, who I love, and I loved him when I saw him in person, and I just loved everything. I hung on every word that he said. I would never feel comfortable calling him or any of the brethren a liar, because I sincerely believe that the men that lead this church today and the men that have led this church since its inception are doing the best they can to make sure that the mission of the church is being completed. And so now I don't think that there's this malice intent, but still, if what they're trying to do is to keep me in ignorance so that I enter heaven in ignorance, right, I would rather not enter heaven in ignorance, and I would rather potentially enter a lower level of heaven with full knowledge of what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that deception? I mean, in every form, that is
decisions for myself.
Let me make the decisions for myself, because I know in a patriarchal system or a hierarchical system that the people that are above me think they know what's better for me than what I know. And that's kind of the narrative, that the prophets know better than me, so why don't I just follow what the prophets and apostles are telling me and not question. The problem is an interesting point to make is I've never given them that authority over me. Similar to the you know, over the last couple of years, the national security, the NSA surveillance, right? It's a huge topic in the U.S. And all of a sudden, everybody in the U.S. says, what? You guys are spying on us? We didn't give you authority to spy over us. And they may say, you know, yeah, but
you wanted me to stop terrorism.
Lives.
Yeah,
but we save lives. We have this, we have actually prevented acts of from happening because we did this. And us as a country, we value freedom and freedom of information that we say, I don't care. I didn't give you authority to do that. And I never gave anybody authority to make decisions for me, because even according to the narrative I was given, that's Satan's plan, that I will, by any means necessary, make it back to God. That's not, and that's kind of what I agreed to, is that I would make decisions based off of that information. So all of that wrapped in, I think it's important to note that it's not been all along. I mean, there were times that the narrative could have been changed. There were times that people knew information. You know, I know probably harping on the images that are in the church about the translation of the Book of Mormon get tiresome, but there was and still is today the opportunity to make those changes to prevent false information from being portrayed in any way. And rather than take ownership for that, we say, well, that's just an artist's depiction. And we leave them up. So it's hard for me to say, and again, I'm trained not just, you know, me, but I think most people have some training with all of the fraud and everything that's prevalent to say, this seems suspicious. I'm skeptical of everything. Why is nothing happening? And when, you know, any questions of these things are brought up, that's not a faithful answer. That's not a faithful way to approach it. We just need to trust. And so, you know, it's hard, I guess.
Thank you. And dang, you're articulate at midnight. Anyway, hey, okay, I want to engage you a little bit. And Brian, I want to bring you in. And Lisa, you're going to be jumping in soon, I hope. Okay, so jump in. Was there anything in this exchange so far that you want to talk about right now, Lise?
Yeah, if I can.
Oh, sure, go for it.
I'm super interested in sort of defining a little bit what we're talking about lying, because it seems to me we've got a couple of different categories. One is people who are pursuing historical documents, people who don't explain with faith seem to be described as being without testimony and can't be trusted. That's one kind of lie. So that anything that's historical, you shouldn't look at, shouldn't go there. This sort of a broad category that could be called lying. Okay. One would be redacting what is known, excising different parts of a history, giving only one first vision story, talking about the Urim and Thummim instead of the seer stone, redacting history. That's another kind of so-called lying. And another one could be some kind of official statement, either from an individual church leader or that seems to be official history, that says that something doesn't exist or something doesn't happen, when later it's determined that there were good records that said that it did. So is that ignorance or is that lie? Those seems to be
lying of denial. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Three important categories, and maybe could be treated or at least talked about differently, because they seem to be different gradations, and some of them apply more to what Brian's talking about than others, I think.
Right. So, Brian, do you think that's the right gradation, that the order gets more serious as you go? Especially the third one seems like for sure the worst, right? When you sit there and say, no, those records don't exist, you know.
Yeah. I think that if the churches or church leaders are caught, in what I would call a bald-faced lie, where they say, no, this doesn't exist, and then we find out that it does, then they're definitely accountable to that. There's no question.
Do we have, Adam, you used the example of the vault. Do you know of any others? Do you have others in mind that Lisa picked up on?
I'm not familiar with any specific stories from the vault. So, Adam, if you have one.
Yeah, Adam.
I mean, no, it's not. It isn't that there is fact. There's definitely information in the vault that would be damaging to the faith that they're willfully denying me access to. It's that there is information in that vault that they're denying me access to for some reason or another. And so, you know, when one of the motivations for fraudulent activity, I'm not saying, I don't think that any of this is fraudulent necessarily in the malice, negligence. Yeah, exactly. Maybe negligence, but is trying to cover up a mistake or something that you're embarrassed about is often the start of, you know, of a fraud happening. So financial or non-financial fraud, when people are trying to limit my access to information, and it's clear, right? So we have had the seer stone in the vault. And if we listen to Mike Quinn's interview with John DeLynn in Mormon Stories, he provides, you know, he goes in and he said, yeah, there's all of this stuff in the vault that we don't have access to, or he wanted to, you know, he wasn't able to go through, but there is information in there. And so, again, what cat is going to be let out of the bag? I don't know what that is, but they're not allowing me access to that. So unlike every other part of my world, I don't have access to that information because they are deciding which information I have access to.
Exactly. Can I demystify the vault for just a quick second?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And this is also just some updated information that came after Mike Quinn's interview with John DeLynn. So everything is actually out of the vault now. Everything is moved over to the church history archives across the street, not North Temple. That's according to Elder Stephen Snow, that things have progressively moved over there. But the construction of the vault, I think, is really important to understand, because we have this idea that there was some sort of malicious intent in putting things in there and hiding them. And I will absolutely state that, yeah, there were some things that were put in the vault that were put in there because there were, you know, like the Council of 50 Minutes, where they just really weren't sure how damaging this stuff could be to the church. And so they put it in there and hopefully tried to forget about it, you know, so that does occur. But then there's also other instances like the seer stones where it was the safest place to store it. Right. And I'm not saying that meant that they were completely open about it all along. Right. I'm just saying that that's where they were physically putting the artifact. Right. And then from there, things kind of just got left in there. And Mike Quinn talks about this, that the general authorities never really went into the vault. They themselves really didn't know what was in the vault. The secretary.
Yeah, it's called the First Presidency Vault, but yet.
Yeah.
It's hard to, the First Presidency is really going in there.
So I think that sometimes we get this image in our mind that all of the general authorities are completely aware of what's in the vault and all of the records, that they've personally read over these records and pored over them and said, well, we can't release that information because that's going to be too damaging to faith. And then just kind of left it in the vault to try to keep it secret with no access. And I would argue, based on what Mike Quinn has reported, that they themselves didn't know it was in the vault. And I'm going to back that up with the fact that I was actually in the church history department when the Council of 50 records were released over to them. And they had the church historians read them first. The first people that actually read the Council of 50 minutes were church historians. And then they reported back to the general authorities and told them what was in them. Right. So none of the general authorities had read these prior. And that also gets back to the Joseph Smith Papers Project, that for a lot of the general authorities, and I've heard this in the context of the Church History Department, for a lot of the general authorities, when they got a manuscript from the Joseph Smith Papers to pore over, this was the first time that a lot of this information was made clear to them. Right. And they would make notes and annotations and stuff and, you know, wow and exclamation mark, you know. Now they're getting a historical training like they've never had before.
Crash course,
yeah. Yeah, it is a crash course.
Just to interject on that, I think that it's important to understand why they are now having this crash course.
Oh, the internet,
Yeah, you posted, you said the internet, because if they were not forced to confront the information, then they wouldn't have to look back at what they have. And so now they, I think, have a better understanding that transparency and information is valued in society. So they go back and do this. But had the internet never happened,
that means it's not on their radar. So you can't really blame them, you know.
But
if status quo was working, then they wouldn't have done anything likely, right? So, yeah,
around to a steak, and everybody seems happy with the messaging. You know, that would be their life.
But the thing is in every other organization, virtually every other organization there's a responsibility. Somebody is responsible to make sure information is accurate. So if you're saying, well, I wouldn't believe that fraud would happen at my company because we have a lot of good people and everything is going well, there's negligence that happens if misinformation is being provided and you did nothing to prevent that misinformation by going along and saying that, well, I didn't know this. It's not my job technically because I'm just an apostle to bring people to Christ. It's not my job to make sure that all of the information is out there because my job is just to make sure everything's are functioning well. There has to be some level of governance where people or somebody's responsible to make sure that accurate information is put out. So I understand
and
that
I
that
think
didn't
that
happen.
Started to happen with Marlon K. Jensen. He found, and the new headings for the scriptures, things they were ready to publish, and he goes, "Whoa, stop! Let my gang, look at these things," and he prevented tons of errors and things there, and he just had to do it. I do think we have a structural problem within the church in the sense that if you're not in the top 15, there's such a deference for those guys that it's hard for somebody to come along like the Toyota factory worker who can stop the assembly line. He's empowered to do that. There's hardly anybody that could yell and scream or would dare to do it to say, you cannot go a step further. And it's just it's the deference, it's the calling, it's a mix of everything. But structurally, we've got to move in that direction to where somebody, and I do think that's what we're happening with Elder Snow and Elder Jensen.
A question that I have quickly is, and I agree, I think the motives are to try to bring people to Christ. I think that is, there's no doubt about that. But so the BBC interview that was done with Elder Holland, right? And they brought up the strengthening of the members committee. I'm sure that everybody's seen that or whatever. Sure. And they had directly asked what the strengthening of the members committee was. And he kind of deferred and he sidestepped and it wasn't his. And I love Elder Holland, so I'm not trying to vilify him at all. I'm saying he's, called out and said, well, that was originally put together to try to snuff out polygamists. And so if you're asking me, do I think that that's all the information that Elder Holland had?
Yeah.
I think that his motives were, holy cow, if this comes out, it's going to be damaging to the church, and it may limit the people that come to Christ. But was his action? So I think that's kind of indicative of there's a lot of this happening. It happens all the way down to the lower level where even though these essays are out, somebody would maybe come and ask a bishop who knows full well with the content of these essays. And he would say, well, I know better than you what is good for you. I'm not going to provide you with this information because I'm scared. We live in this milk before meat mentality within the church that you're not to the point where you can handle this information. So I'm not going to provide that. My question, I guess, is do you guys think that there is or there is not at all a mentality of protecting the image of Joseph Smith or the church or valuing loyalty over honesty or information? Do you guys think that that is something that still exists in the church today or over the last 20 years?
For sure.
I have some interest in putting this in a little broader context. The way that Adam's describing it now, I think, seems like a lot of people are thinking of it now. It seems so clear in those terms. And yet, I think beyond just the internet explosion, something socially has happened that makes it hard to
Absolutely.
Go back and see what life was like 50 years ago and what was considered moral. Two aspects of this leap out at me. One is that it was a time when even adoptions were closed. Sure, that's really important information. Now we say, well, gosh, everybody should be entitled to their biology, to their DNA, to what their social history was that they can't even remember. But there was a time when that was considered moral and best, not just to protect some corporation or it was considered best for the child to not be complicated with this information, to have a life. And second example is what we used to do with childhood trauma. If a child experienced the death of his parents, for example, he was shipped off with aunt and uncle and they were never to mention it again because it might bother the child. Or if the child was sexually assaulted, we just didn't talk about it so that nobody's feathers would be ruffled. The solution was just don't think about it. Go to work. Fill your life up with other things. And this didn't represent lying or falsehood in the moral mind. It represented you only have so much energy and time. Let's fill it up with something that's going to be beneficial to you. So yes, it was paternalistic, but it was considered best for mental health. We no longer ascribe to any of that now. But it wasn't done for the purpose of an image or protecting something. I'm not going to say it wasn't done for the purpose of protecting a family narrative, because sometimes it was. But mostly it was done for the purpose of a maturing mind being protected so it could mature. Mm-hmm.
That's so helpful.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely helpful, because I think that kind of points to we as a society in everything, not just in how we look at history, but in everything, we have a shift towards open, you know, transparency, and, you know, we value that transparency, you know, much more. But I guess, is that still happening today at the church? Has that been happening over the last 5 years? And
I think we're seeing a trend. I think we're definitely seeing a trend. I mean, it's the same trend that democracy started, you know, in 1776, the trend toward individual responsibility and accountability, and the desire we all have for enough information to find out what's important to us. And I think when we think in terms of who has the right to say what a lie is or whether something was meant as a lie, whether that even matters, I think it comes back down to determining what's important to us, what we want to know, what we've always wanted to know, what we weren't told, what would have been essential, what we have every right to in all of these issues. For example, young Black members, converts to the church, who don't hear from the missionaries about the church's complicated history with regard to Blacks, can feel quote unquote lied to, even though there may have been nothing said about the church's relationship with Blacks at all. So no lies, no redacting per se, don't think about that. But yet they have a right to feel lied to because it was something that was important to them that wasn't even discussed. And when we're in relationship with something that seems powerful, we kind of hold that institution or that parent or that boss or that person in power to a higher standard. You should, we seem to say, know what's important to me. I'm Black. You should know that this is important to me. Or I've been married 3 times. I would like to know more about what the church says about marriage. Each one of these things seems like a betrayal.
Yeah, just to along those lines, I wonder, so this actually came up all the time. I served my mission in Haiti. And so this particular example that you use was very pertinent to what happened on my mission often. And when it did come up after the fact, it was very difficult to deal with. I guess to me, there's a difference between, you know, not telling somebody about, you know, maybe if I'm African American and I don't tell them about the issues with Blacks in the priesthood or whatever, and then later on it comes out and they feel like I lied to them, or if they come and ask me about it and I tell them don't worry about it, or I provide them information that is a half true just so that they will not question it. Like, there's a difference between that patriarchal, I mean, I guess it kind of falls under the same umbrella, which is, you know, you go back and you ask questions and your shutdown still means that they think that they know what's better for you than what you would know. But they're, you know, I think that's kind of where the lying, I guess, in my mindset or the deceit, because, right, I guess even in the world, deceit is
feels
propagating
deliberate.
Beliefs and things that aren't true. Even if it's the even if it's right, like to me, if you know, I was told something in a way that was deceiving, which is just not even the whole truth, half truths, or even through omission, which is deceit. That's definition of deceit. Then even if it is on the end result is the best result, that still is a deceit that happened. Even if it was with positive intentions, and I know that lying and deceit and these words are really loaded and they're really bad, and we call people a liar, it means that they're just an evil person. There's a sense of evil to it, even if the intentions were positive. But if you go and you ask, which has happened to me, I feel like, you know, I think a lot of people do, when you go and you ask and you're shut down, or you're told not to discuss it, or you're told not to bring it forward, or you find out that people knew some information and then they continued to let information or stories being told with, you know, heavily redacted, you know, heavily omitted, and then you press about why that happened and you're being stifled, then, you know, that's, I mean, it is, I don't think that the church, I think anybody that has a product or any company or anybody, they're not required to give you all the negative reviews right. of the product. They're going to sell a product and they're going to give you 10 customer reviews about how great the product is. So I don't think it's the responsibility of the church to have maybe an ex-Mormon tell you why the church is bad or why their narrative is a horrible narrative. But when you're asked about it and the information is available, or somebody knows that information, or they, you know, somebody's responsible to give you that information and they don't willfully, or they provide you with something that isn't fully true knowingly, that it's not fully true. I think there's a difference there.
Very good.
So it's interesting to be in this interim space between the where it used to be and where it yet will be. And I always relate it to individual relationships, to personal relationships, the big, the macro and the micro. And whenever we find that we're not getting the information that we want, it's important that we speak up and ask for it, or that we say that we feel betrayed, or that we share what it is that we're looking for and what we expected, and hold both people and institutions accountable. When we cross over then and label it or give it motives or put it in a particular light, we may be telling our own version of a truth that may not be the full truth either.
Good. So is there something about when you're saying that it's important to speak up when this is your experience interpersonally, does that need to sort of be in a therapeutic situation? Or, I mean, to me, I think couples that are really have healthy relationships naturally do that. But yet when you're talking about here, does there need to be some sort of structural spaces created for that kind of dialogue, Lise, or is it, can it be the free for all? Because right now it does seem like people are saying what they want from the church, and yet they're not doing it in a way that the church is really hearing them. Or they are,
right?
They are, because I think there's so much going on behind the scenes that we're not quite seeing, you know. And you have to get the unanimity.
Well, absolutely.
And all that
I'm
stuff.
Delighted
yeah.
to hear what right. Brian's describing about church leaders looking over the documents right. and getting to know them. That's a precursor to all kinds of openness, I think.
Yeah. But is there some way that you would recommend somebody saying, here is what I want, or here is what you, when you do this, this is how it affects and feels to me. I guess I'm just looking if, in case you've thought of some structural way to kind of create a mode where that could be heard.
Well, my wish and my hope is that, and of course this doesn't even happen in all personal relationships, but that when people feel what Adam has been describing, they can actually go to the leader that said, this information is not good for you, and say, actually, I found this information has been really good yes. for me, and I hope that you will present it to others or allow others to discover it as well. The one-on-one, it seems to have the most positive effect in the long run for the person who feels betrayed. And most of the things that Adam's been talking about do seem to be things that he was told personally by people when he was seeking additional information. And the empathy that he feels for people who have been similarly lied to or betrayed also seem to be individual conversations had with either teachers or bishops or some kind of personal interaction. So I think personal interaction and responsiveness might be useful.
See, I also wonder, just on this point too, is there is a sense in the church of loyalty. You know, this is where the lying for the Lord is, but loyalty trumps everything. So if it is loyal to the church to not provide the full picture to someone that's, you know, I think is missionary, somebody brings up something, you don't really want to talk about something that's uncomfortable. And a lot of church members are very uncomfortable because I think it may cause them to wonder how loyal they are to the church. So, I mean, while I think even today the motives are to be loyal to the church because this is God's one true kingdom on earth, and that is the number one goal, or that should be the number one thing on everybody's mind, is how loyal are we to the church currently, it clashes with everything else that's going on in this world, which is information at my fingertips when I want it and, you know, immediately. And so I think that's, there is, I mean, I see that that's a push, you know, that's probably a part of the problem that we're being had. But I think, you know, to Lisa's point, also, I don't know if I can tell somebody that they weren't lied to when people who were agents of the church, who represent the church, told me things knowingly that were not full truths. Maybe that's through omission, but those are practices. Even if, I mean, I think for me, I'm a really good example because I joined the church, and I don't know if I would have joined the church had I known all of this information. I joined the church. I probably was headed down a path that was not uplifting. It was probably going to lead me to probably not the best circumstances. Not that I, you know, I'm not going to cry over a testimony saying I'd be dead if I didn't join the church. But I joined the church. I joined with a community. I went home teaching with a man that was very successful in a career field that I had no idea existed. He encouraged me to seek that career field out. I went on a mission. I was motivated to get educated. And here I am, married with two children, you know, in a career that's promising for me. And I think I owe that, honestly, to my decision to join the church. And so it worked in my case. And had I known all of this information, even if I asked for it, would I have joined the church? I'm not 100% sure if I would have or not, because I, you know, but I would have liked to have been given the opportunity to have built my testimony on something that I trust now, because I didn't have limited information. And I don't think I gave anybody that authority to decide what my testimony should have been based on. And so now I'm kind of in this situation. I may not be in this situation had I never joined the church, but maybe I would be in this situation and have a much stronger testimony had information not been purposely limited to me. Yeah. And this milk before meat concept is so ingrained in the church that we say, well, we can't provide this information until we really think that they're loyal to the church. And now once their loyalty is first secured, then we'll provide the information. And that's just, that isn't honest to me, I guess.
Is it Bill Reel who has the line about when he hears the milk before meat, he's going to say, you know what, I'm lactose intolerant.
Yeah, I think
you know,
so.
I need meat. You know, I'm sorry, you can keep saying this until the church is ready, then we'll get more. No, I'm lactose intolerant. I need to chew on something now. So I think it's Bill Reel, but it was somebody recently.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Now, is it too – okay, I don't want us to stay on the – podcast a super long amount, but I want to ask one thing first, and then I want to turn a question to Lise. But my question came up a little bit 5 minutes ago or something, Adam, when you said, you know, at the push of a button, I can get my information pretty much anywhere else. We have arrived at that point within Mormonism to where, with the push of a button, you can get all the information that you want to know about all the different historical things, because if we consider the church more than just the leaders and the institutional thing, Mormonism now does have that available to you. So I guess I'm wondering, do we really even want our church leaders to be the leader in providing that information, or Would the question almost to me is more like, do we want them just to step out of the way and let the internet and the information age do its thing? I don't know, Adam. I'm totally throwing out a spitball.
No, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I don't want my church leaders telling me to not look at that information. So, yeah, I would want the church out of it completely. And when I find this information, and I think it would be hard to, you know, if there's a lot of obviously subjective sources that are, you know, people that are anti whatever the faithful narrative, it would be important for somebody, and I guess that is the institutional church, to provide an alternative narrative that is faithful. I could point to Brian Hales, who has information, he paid money to receive information and to do the research, and he put it out there for everybody to have. He's uploading it to a website for all of us to have. So
that's a good model.
Yeah, and he's a faithful person, and he does represent the church, and he's not telling me to not look. And maybe I don't agree with everything he has to say, but he's not telling me not to look. Whereas we hear at conference, not everything on the internet, don't trust those things on the internet. You know, I think they're actively telling you not to look.
Nice. Brian, what do you think as far as that question I just kind of threw out about, you know, seeing how the church now, if we consider it as a body of all of us, it is functioning that way. Is it one of those, like, be careful what you wish for when, like I think Adam answered it right. I want them to at least know this information as well, but I don't necessarily want them to lead out. Is that somewhere in the ballpark where you'd land on that?
Sure. Yeah. And Richard Bushman is, you know, he's the first to say that the church should really get out of the history business. Because you don't want a bunch of untrained historians again, handling our history. We've seen what's happened with that. So I love the fact that we have a really rich pool of professionally trained historians, that are across the street. But you know, this brings back to memory, probably my first week working there in the church history department. And I was in one of the director's offices. The window was overlooking the church office building, the Cobb, as we call it, the large building. And across the street from that to the north is the church history library. And, you know, we were looking over across the street, and he's looking out the window. He turns back to me, and he's kind of got a smirk on his face. And he was pointing out the road that separates the two, which is North Temple. And he says, you know, sometimes this road can feel really, really wide. And the point that he was making with me is that the departments really don't work that closely together. And that's something that I witnessed when I was over there. So I think that that's another misconception that we have, is that all of these departments are kind of working together, all aware of what each other's putting out. They're aware of what each other's doing. And yeah, we do have this correlation department that's kind of, the end of where everything kind of ends up before it gets greenlit. But right. Interdepartmentally, they don't really work with each other that much. And like you mentioned, Dan, Marlon K. Jensen had to fight to get the updates to the headings changed, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, it was almost like this revelation of sort where they're like, oh,
you guys have something to contribute.
You actually, yeah, wait a second. There's historians sitting over there. And then, and then they brought over their curriculum changes for 2000. Well, I don't know if it's going to be rolled out in 2016, but that's what it was geared for, is for the Doctrine and Covenants curriculum change. And, you know, they let historians take a look at that and give their feedback. Now, I don't know what they're going to do with it. That doesn't mean that they're actually going to implement the changes, but at least the historians have a voice to being able to put something in there. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, should the general authorities be the handlers of history? No, clearly not. I don't want somebody who has been trained in, you know, in mostly in business or mostly in being a medical professional. I don't want them to all of a sudden have to become historians. I want historians to be historians, but I do think that they should be educated. Absolutely. And I do know that there are weekly meetings now. That are bringing up to speed a lot of the lack of education.
Sweet. Yeah, my full sense is that we're trending in the right direction. It's, you know, and it's never going to go as fast as we want it to.
Can I respond to something Lisa said? Because I think it was really, really on point for what we're at. When she said this is really broader trends that we're talking about here of society's shift. And Adam's been bringing this up too, about this full disclosure mentality that we have now. And it's, and both of them, I think, agree with us that it is really a recent phenomenon that we've arrived at where information and full disclosure information and skepticism over organizations for not disclosing full information has become important to us. And that's really, I mean, I would say really within the past 10, 15 years that that's really started to emerge among the younger generation predominantly. When you're looking at the 50s and 60s and even the early 70s, particularly within conservative religious groups, it was a completely different viewpoint on information presentation and on what's important to know, and the idea that secrecy was okay, the idea that keeping things that were of a scandalous nature muted was okay. Now that just really rubs us the wrong way. Now it's like, no, you need to let me make that decision. Just like Adam said, you need to let me make that decision. You can't tell me what is scandalous in nature. But this is new, and really, in history, we talk about the historical lenses that we view things through. And one of the terms that we like to throw around is this consensus-built history that was really popular in the 1950s and 60s as a product of the Cold War era, and the idea that you don't criticize the nation, you don't criticize the leaders of the nation, right? So this is ingrained in our society. Now, during the 1960s social revolution, all that gets flipped on its head, and we go into what we call postmodernism. And postmodernism is starting to look for those contradictions and starting to look where things break down and look where the standard narrative doesn't work. And that's where we've arrived at today. We're a postmodern society, at least with the younger generation. And we have an older generation of church leadership that are still kind of in that consensus history, or what we call that great man school of thought, where you puff up the past leaders. You don't denigrate them. You don't call out their flaws, per se. And it's just, it's not working for the younger generation. So, and to respond to Adam, you know, I agree with, I think we both agree that there's no question that they mismanaged the history. They did a lousy job of presenting the history, and they are paying for what I think was willful ignorance, but, you know, other people do definitely see it differently. They are paying for that now. And there is a being caught up to speed kind of thing going on for sure.
But there's still a lot of wounded in the wake, you know, from all those.
Oh, yeah, yeah, there. Absolutely. And
that's
what
we need to honor here, and that's kind of the last phase I want to go into here. So I guess, you know, the initial criticism you received, Brian, and it led to you changing the title and a bit of, you know, kind of the structure, or not necessarily structure, but the language of transitions in the piece, was, again, you're recommending and you're telling me how I should feel. You're telling me what language to use and stuff like that. And so all the things that Adam's brought up here, you know, that was definitely, you know, there. And to your credit, you honored it and you saw it. Lisa is here. And Lisa, you've contributed so much. Thank you. Your framing's, everything's been so wonderful. I want you as a therapist to do something for me here. And that is to kind of say, let's honor Adam and the idea that we need to be able to use the word liar. We need to be able to use the word lied, deception, fraud, whatever it is. Those are, it's probably healthy to actually say those words out loud to some degree. Is there a point in which words like that, though, can turn unhealthy? So, again, this is like the danger zone of recommending, you know, an approach for somebody else because we know what's best. But, Lisa, can you just kind of sit in a therapist chair and kind of say, in any kind of healing, you know, the power of naming or something, kind of.
Sure, you bet. And I think Adam actually already did a really good job of setting the stage for this when he said, I feel lied to. I experience being lied to. I experience not having the information I was asking for. I experienced that what I was looking for was denied me. And someone told me this was the best way to be. And I trusted them and they were wrong. That experience happened. It was real. And yet he wouldn't go so far as to say, I believe someone deliberately lied to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Being able to say what our experience is, being able to name it, define it, it's very good for mental health. being able to blame someone else for a motive, however, is not good for anyone, unless it's a court of law when you can actually prove it.
Okay, so that, would you say that's a, you're making that as a firm statement, and to say it again, it's healthy for this, but it's not healthy for that.
It's healthy to define an experience and say, this is my experience, this is what happened to me. But to say, therefore, someone had a motive to do this to me, to assign blame, is not always good for a relationship.
But it can be, but it's really rare. I guess I'm just trying to, you know, is this a 90% law or, you know.
Well, if what you're trying to do is to assign blame, to assign responsibility in order for restitution to occur, then it's good.
It's okay. All right. Mm-hmm. But if not, it's probably going to make you stuck too, because in some ways, when I externalize blame and just put it out there, it means I'm probably not going to do some internal work that's really life is calling me to do.
Exactly. I'm not going to really own my own experience. I'm going to say that my experience is the result of what someone else did. When actually my growth is going to come from my examining my own experience. How did I come to that? And part of that is actually being able to go and tell the people that helped create this experience what your experience was. That's really where the greatest growth can come in relationship, is to actually be able to say to other people, here's what I experienced when I had this conversation with you. Here's what my experience was like when you took this approach with me. And really good growth can come from that. But until we actually own it, then we'll end up in that conversation blaming the other person or blaming the other institution or making it so that they created the problem.
Okay. Now, is there at a certain point in this, again, so you're saying it, you don't want to place the blame. Is it important to still always be able to use these loaded words, but just not make them the only words you use? You know, in other words, I do sense that there was lying, there was deceit, there was deliberate dissembling, etc. Or at some point, do these words like carry a signature with them, or some kind of energy with them that maybe is dangerous always?
Well, I think words that assign motives do have a critical, an energy of criticism that can be corrosive. But I think you can still use pretty heavy, important words to say, when I ask you for information about this aspect of church history, whether Joseph Smith actually had additional wives, and you told me that that was not important to my salvation, I'd like to tell you what happened and how devastating it was for me. This inhibited my growth. This was bad for me. This did not work well for me. I think it's okay to talk in those terms.
Okay, good. Now, okay, I'm just keeping pushing you here. I agree. I am totally on board. At some point, should the narrative then shift, though, or is that a narrative that, you know, I get to say over and over again for 15 years and be a healthy person? Or, you know, tell me more about a healthy shift. And again, we're generalizing here, and we're in all the danger zones that Adam, you know, talked about. So I'm that. But,
you're asking me to be paternalistic. Is that what you mean?
Well, I guess I'm just trying to say is, you know, some people will have that story and they get that catharsis and they'll say that out there. But is there next steps, and do those next steps involve maybe new language?
Here's where the therapy rubber meets the road, and that is that as long as a person really feels like there's emotion behind their story that they want to share, either they haven't taken complete responsibility for it yet, they still need processing. That is, they still need validation. They still need, there's something there that hasn't yet been processed. So as therapists, we generally don't ever say, you know what, I think you're ready to move on and you just aren't doing it yet. So we all know people who continue to tell victim stories.
Right.
And my guess is that they need some sort of owning of whatever it was that they they brought to it that they can't see yet. For example, when someone tells us that we don't really need to know this and we trustingly move on, there's part of us that we haven't yet acknowledged that says, you know, I got to trust myself on this instead of someone else. And as soon as that part comes to consciousness and that part becomes developed, then we no longer look back and say, well, you took advantage of me, you powerful person. We say, yeah, I just wasn't ready to take responsibility for my own belief about what I really needed. And
then you have a new foundation to build on. That's
right. You have a new,
your growth. Yeah. Versus
exactly. And so your narrative changes, your desire to punish changes, the way that you see your own history changes.
Now, I agree that that's healthy, and I'm going to let Adam tell us where we've screwed up there. But I also want to add in at this point, this is not easy stuff. This is not easy work. It's not like, hey, think about it this way. You should be fixed tomorrow, you know, or not fixed, but you should, you know, spin your tail
resolved,
a different
yeah.
way. You know, this is deep soul work. And,
and
so
it's
I don't want to like that this is easy because, you know, I get criticized a lot when, like, you know, I had that interview with John DeLynn, for instance, and it's like, well, you're just saying that you're no longer interested in these questions, you know, Weatherspoon. Well, there's lots of us who are interested in these questions, and it's so difficult to almost say, like, you know, I'm centered in something else now, so those questions just aren't even in the top 10 anymore. I always wanted to try to always remember to say, and I sometimes forget to do it, is, yeah, I remember when those were my killer questions too. Now they're not, but then you move into that area where, like, oh, you're now saying you're more mature than me because I'm still stuck in those questions. And it's just like this big frickin' mess, Lise. It's an impossible, you know, conundrum here to kind of share your own experience without almost making it sound paternalistic, so.
Right, but let's just say that our emotions of feeling betrayed are per se meaningful, valuable, and there is not a shelf life or a half life. They're meaningful as long as they're meaningful.
Right, good. Okay, Adam.
You know, that I mean, everything she said is exactly how I feel. I think it's probably exactly how many people feel. It's the, you know, maybe it's not the best example, but it's the story of a child who grew up under a father or a mother that was heavy-handed with them. And, you know, not everything of their childhood was bad, and there's a lot of positive that came out of that childhood, but they are stuck with some emotional baggage or something that maybe came as a result of how they were raised. And they bring that up potentially through therapy or through something, and the parent says, I'm sorry, I did these things wrong. Now, you know, in my mind, if that were to have happened to me, I think I would have to be done, right? I'd have to say, well, thank you. I guess I can't come, you know, I appreciate that. Now let's move forward. So if who I think was responsible or who I think injured me or whatever may have happened, who I think was responsible for giving me information when I asked for it that they didn't, through just a culture that the church had, if they don't come forward and say, yeah, I'm sorry, we should have done that, then I feel like I haven't been able to move on. It's like Elder Durant in the conference, right? The ponderizing thing that was everywhere. He, you know, he had the thing. It was super suspicious. The website that his son made, he came out Monday morning and said, I made a bad judgment call. I should have stopped that from happening. Mm-hmm. And I read that and I said, it's over. I don't even want to be involved in the discussion because the man said, I shouldn't have done that. That was a bad judgment call. Let's move forward. Now, and the other thing is if I had my trust was shaken in that man and then he came out and apologized to me, my trust maybe is more than restored in that man. So if that hasn't happened for me or anybody that may feel this way by the church, and instead we are met with, stop saying you're lying. No, that's not what it is. It sounds kind of like other things, other types of apologetics that may invalidate something that's very real, because I could say by any definition that I look at deception, it happened. to me, and it happened institutionally as a church, and maybe it was a result of, you know, that's how things were, but still it happened. So just until you validate that happened, until you own that, I don't feel like it's going to be really hard to move on.
Good stuff. And so that, again, another point of argument for why it has to be better apologies, better sense of accountability and owning it up. So thank you on that. I have one more angle to take Lisa down. Brian, do you have anything, or Lisa, do you have any more at this point, either one of you?
I'd like to just say one thing. Adam just said something that was kind of a light bulb went off in my head, that when I say maybe it's time for us to stop saying the church lied to us, that a lot of people are probably reading that as maybe it's time to stop saying that my parents abuse me. And you're right, Adam, that has, you know, if people feel that they've been abused, then what I'm saying is extremely challenging. I'm saying, stop saying that your parents abused you. And that, you're right, would be a healthy part of beginning to deal with the process of being an abused child, is in admitting and taking that status of, yes, I have been abused, by my parents. So I, you know, thank you for kind of bringing that depth of it out to me. Some of it for me probably comes from the grounding of not having had the same kind of, you know, experiences that a lot of people have had of feeling this abusive relationship. I really haven't felt that, which could be coming from a place of privilege for me, fully admittedly. But there's something that Brent Metcalf actually said on my blog that really also struck me. And he's right. And we had a little private conversation about this, and I don't think he'll mind me sharing. He said that he agreed with everything that I put in my posts as far as how we arrived at the kind of historical mess that we're in. But he said the thing that really offended him is that I said, it's a shame that people are hurting now. And I said it three times, that it's, you know, that this is a shame and that's a shame. And he said, no, wait a second. You know, paraphrasing, he said, this is more than a shame for me. You know, he said, I was excommunicated over this. I contributed to a volume that the church excommunicated me over. Shame is too weak of a word for him. And I said, you're right. For you, it's an injustice. And I would say the same thing for Mike Quinn. It's an injustice in that case. And so I would agree that the church does need to apologize for that. And I think that the first person that needs an apology is Mike Quinn, of all people. And, you know, and then I think we,
amen,
you know, from there on out. So,
powerful. Yes,
you know, yeah.
From both Brandon and about Mike. Thank you. So good. Lisa, do you have anything more at this point before I try to just close with one more angle on you?
No. Okay. Go ahead.
So here's what I want to fold back in Brian something at the earlier, and this is again about narratives that people tell, and it was the idea of Brian was wondering if post-Mormon narratives seem to have this I was lied to as an essential piece of them. Is there anything that, I mean, what's your reaction to that suggestion? I don't know, Brian, were you putting that forth as a thesis that you want to have somebody argue back for, or was it just more of a wondering? Because to me, it strikes me as, you know, it might be, it, a lot of the energy for those narratives come from that.
Yeah, I just want to hear thoughts on it. Okay. I don't have a thesis.
Okay, so Lisa, did you catch that earlier, and do you have some thoughts on that right now? As again, just the sort of healthy narrative for a post-Mormon, you know, is that a piece that is healthy? I don't know, or required? Again, and I'm totally putting you on the spot.
Well, I think it's pretty important for people to be able to articulate the aspects of their experience that are meaningful to them or that give life to the directions that they're going, both for themselves and for the people who care about them, who are also on the journey with them. I think what Brian was suggesting is that maybe when people feel disaffected, they feel like they want to blame other people, or they want to blame the institution for why they feel disaffected. And then that gets complicated. If they've had experiences where they feel either personally lied to, or They feel virtually lied to because they identify with other people who have been directly lied to. Then that becomes maybe an essential part of their experience. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say from person to person how salient that is in their disaffection.
Yeah. I guess I'm going to open myself and get into more criticism here by saying, because there is sort of a blame piece there, and we talked earlier about blame not being, you know, and then there's that sense of that means I want somebody other than me to be responsible, you know, in some degree. What would be a healthy post-Mormon narrative, to me, seems to be one that you're now past that needing to say this piece of it, because you're past needing to even justify why you're post-Mormon. You know what I mean? Because I think early on in a post-Mormon narrative, it's like you have to give your reasons. Here's A, B, C, D, E, and therefore my exit. Would you say, or can you say, a healthy narrative at some point probably just doesn't even worry about justifying it anymore, and therefore something like this might fall away?
Yeah, that makes sense. But I think we're all connected with other people, and we all try to find reasons for what it is we're doing. And explain myself. So yes, at some point, our own reasons need no justification. Our preferences are what really matters.
My new life is already proof enough of I had good reasons, you know.
Exactly. But we are talking about an institution and being part of it that does take an approach of fatherly care, and so we tend to expect more from it, and we tend to have reactions to it, and we tend to trust it, and then feel like we need to pull away from it a little as we become more autonomous, more differentiated. And then if we find our own spirituality, we can come back to it at a more mature level.
Yeah,
so
right.
Some of that give and take, and some of that blame, and some of that self-blame, and that's all part of the growth of maturity.
Awesome. Thanks for making me not feel totally idiotic asking that question. Adam, did I trigger anything in you with my speculations here, or I don't know what you'd call what I was doing?
No, I mean, you know, and it's hard for me because I'm not in that post-Mormon
crowd.
I'm certainly not there, but so maybe for people that have undergone a faith transition or currently are, or reevaluating things or whatever we're calling it, maybe that's the struggle where, I mean, coming into this podcast, I was concerned that I was going to portray myself to be much angrier than I am, even at this discussion, because I don't actually feel that angry toward the church anymore. I mean, I did. And in looking at how the church handled things in its history, as Brian laid out, or even is currently handling things, or the way they handled things, you know, 13 years ago or 15 years ago when I joined the church, I may have done the same thing. Like, I understand that the motives were there. I don't feel comfortable now with this saying that at any cost, I will do whatever it takes to bring somebody into the church. And that may include omitting things. And so I do feel lied to, but I don't know if for me, I have to own the church as a bunch of liars. And I've felt that from maybe more post-Mormon people. And that's why I can't relate to them, because they have a narrative that doesn't really mesh with what I see. So I don't want to invalidate those people that feel stronger than I do either.
Thank you very much. And you, to me, I hope your fears, you've felt like you have portrayed yourself fairly and all that. Cause I think you didn't come across more negative. I think you really did a fantastic job at 1 a.m. now, or 10 minutes to 1.
That's fine. I can go all night.
No, we're going to end here. Just last thing, Brian, I started the discussion. You said your whole point was, I want more discussion on this. Did we trigger anything for you, or is there any final comment you'd want to make on that? I wonder if this is an essential part.
Well, so, I mean, I come from the grounding that context matters, and that if we can see things more clearly by looking at their context, then we can make better decisions about how we feel about them. And when we don't have that ability to see things in their broader context, then we're running off of assumptions for our feelings, which are not always correct. Now, I have to be careful because when I go down that road, it can very much feel like I'm invalidating personal feelings by saying, well, you don't understand the context, so therefore your feelings are invalid.
Right, exactly.
And nice. And I really need to learn how to parse that out better in my writing and in my personal life, because that's not what I'm implying. I'm not implying that your feelings are invalid. I'm implying that your information may not be correct or complete, and that if the better context and understanding was available to you, then perhaps you may end up being able to think about something differently. It may change your feelings. It may not change your feelings. I'm not saying that this is just going to fix it, but I do think that in this particular case of such a big question of, have I been lied to by the church? Have they willingly deceived me in some way? I think it is important to understand the context that the history was generated from as one piece of saying, of being able to make that decision on that question. But the bottom line is that we're never going to fully understand motive. No historian can say this is exactly what the motive was. I mean, even if people state this was my motive, you still have to question that, right? So we're never going to fully understand motive because we can't get into the minds of somebody else. So really what I'm presenting is an alternative to the very common, in my opinion, the very common narrative that I see that places this us versus them dichotomy within. So we are now part of this group that says that that agrees with each other and has this consensus about us that the church has willfully manipulated information. And they kind of bolster each other up on this narrative. And that's what I push back on and think, in my opinion, that that's not a healthy way to continue to process it. I don't see it transitioning into something that is more beneficial. I see it self-perpetuating, and that concerns me. And that's was my whole point of writing the article.
You know, if I can just say, Brian, on the article, I think what you're doing is actually very positive, because to focus on the motive of the why things were done this way, I think it helps people who maybe feel like they can't trust any longer. I don't trust the brethren because this is a systematic way that things have gone, and it is with malice intended, to try to clarify that, hey, this, there was no malice. Then even if I don't agree with how things were done, or even if I still feel lied to because there's purposeful withholding of information when it was requested, it still allows me to say, but I still trust that you're a good person, that you're doing the best you can. I can still trust that you're a servant of the Lord and that you actually speak for the Lord. So maybe I don't trust that your information that you provide me is always objective, but now I trust that you are, that you don't have a motive to hurt me. So I think that's a success of what you're writing and that approach to everything as well. So I think that kind of narrative certainly serves a purpose.
Awesome. All I can say is well done. Well done for tonight's conversation. Well done, Brian, for the conversation that you started. I think you did. You walked that good balance of, hey, I'm just putting some more information out here, and I know some people heard that as like, oh, you're trying to invalidate my feelings and things like that. But the way you reacted there, and even the way you framed it here at the end of, you know, this is something I'm still working on, and how I parse and how I, you know, phrase and stuff like that, it just shows the path that you're on, and it's a path to be honored, and I really appreciate the good work that you did.
Can I just say something real quick, Dan? So sure. The title,
because
that's really what I've gotten hit hard on more than the content. In fact, I mean, Infants on Thrones put out their podcast this week about my blog, and they admitted that they didn't even read it because to them it was just boring. So for them it was the title, and they said this is going to be a smackdown of the title, and man, that's really what blew up. So my big learning points from this is, number one, the power of a clickbait title. All right. So, and I want to clear the record on this, that When I put together this blog post and I was considering what title to put on it, my original title actually was History versus Heritage. And then I said, well, that's probably not going to get a lot of interest.
I
put out another post earlier when the Seer Stone photo was released, and I called it the Historiography of Seer Stones, and it got about 900 page views, which is fine. Not a lot of feedback. You know, few historical nerds said, oh, this is interesting, this is useful information, but that was about it. So I thought, well, I would like to put out a title that's going to get a little bit more interest, but I didn't expect this, right? I really honestly didn't. Yeah. So it really taught me a lesson in how powerful a title piece can be. And especially considering that, you know, and I hate to say it, but probably 50% of the people that responded didn't actually read the article. They were just responding to the title with an emotional reaction. So if I could
you've made your point there, but you modeled how you're supposed to handle that, and you were humble and there was a lot to learn and a lot to admire in how you engaged and the change that you did make. So clickbait, that was a great phrase. I guess I might have been the first time I'd been exposed to it, but it's certainly a perfect the perfect description for a title like that. But anyway, thank you again. Adam, thank you for your engagement in that post, and thank you for tonight. Boy, you just hit a home run. So thank you very much. And Lise, couldn't even imagine a better conversation partner than you. So thank you very much for all you shared. You're just the best, man. We have had some good conversations in our lives, you and I. So glad I got to share one with everybody. But thanks, guys. Listeners, jump in with your own thoughts. This was wonderful, accurate. Are there things that you wish we'd brought up that we hadn't? Are there questions that you have? Are there things that you want to engage the panelists on, or just share about this general topic in your own thinking? Please do. Please come to the MormonMatters.org website and share your thoughts there. Let's keep the discussion going. Just appreciate all the interactions that we get. While you're at the website, I hope that you might shop the Mormon Matters bookshelf or just the Amazon portal that goes through Mormon Matters. That's a way of, doing something you're going to normally do anyway, but I get a little bit of peace of action. And then, of course, the amazing and wonderful donations that you give. If you haven't done it in a while, please do it again. It helps so much. If you'd like to subscribe, there's a button there. I know this is getting into the year-end season, and a lot of you will be thinking about who you might support with some of your charitable dollars. And if Mormon Matters ends up on your list, I will be a very happy camper. Like I say, I never like talking about this, but it's so important, and I love it so much. Panelists, thanks again, Brian, Adam, Lisa. Anyway, just wish you guys a good night and just wow.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at MormonMatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at MormonMatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.